This is the podcast for Monday, March 12th, 2012. Theories of knowledge. So we have to finish up a couple of things. First, on religious knowledge, and then talk about moral knowledge, and then to move on to political knowledge. So a couple of announcements. First one of which is that the final exam will be available Wednesday at 3:30. So if you want to get in there and take it early, be my guest. You can take it through all during final exam week up to Thursday at 5 o'clock of final exam week, which is next week, not this week. But it'll be open after class, after Wednesday's class, which is the last class of the term. Yes?
The extra credit, is it open now and through Friday? Is that what I'm...
So that's my second announcement, a couple of announcements. So, any questions about the final? It won't be comprehensive. 3x5 note card, both sides. Testing lab, same drill as the first two exams. Were the same as the first two exams?
It's not comprehensive.
The final exam is not, right.
So it's chapters?
Everything after Kant, which is, well, I don't know what the numbers are.
5, 6, and 7.
Not including Kant?
Not including Kant. Well, hold on a second. No, including Kant. No, wait. Was Kant in the last exam?
Yes, he was.
Okay, I'm just... Yeah. So I used to have Kant on the final. So, yeah, just the last three chapters, 5, 6, and 7. Belief and will. And religious knowledge and moral and political knowledge. So the final will be open after class at 3:30 and available through the end of the week, including Saturday and all during finals week, until Thursday at 5 o'clock. Remember, the lab closes during final exam week. It closes Thursday at 5. It doesn't close at 7 o'clock on Thursday during final exam week. It closes early at 5 o'clock, like it's Friday. It's not open Friday. Don't show up Friday to final exam week expecting to take your final. You'll end up getting either an F or incomplete, depending on my mood that day. So make sure you get in there by Thursday or before. Now, the extra credit exam, which is comprehensive and covers only material from weeks 1 through 9, that is available right now, and it will be only available through Friday, this week, Friday at 5. So you have to take it in the testing lab like the other exams. It's made up of questions drawn for the first two exams, and I've thrown in a couple of other ones, a handful of new questions as well. It's 50 questions. So no penalty for taking it. If you didn't do as well as you had expected or hoped on the either of the two exams, or you have a bad feeling about the coming final, or you just want to take every opportunity accorded to you to get a good grade in this class, then you know, take it this week before Friday at 5. And 3x5 note card, both sides, same deal.
So that can't damage you if you don't help you.
Right, exactly. And so at the end of the term, you'll get to drop your lowest score of 4. So if you don't take it, you know, you don't get to drop your lowest score if you only have 3. If you do your lowest of, so if you do take it and it's your lowest score, that's the one that gets dropped. The extra credit exam is not a substitute for the final exam. You must take the final exam to pass this class. So if you take the extra credit exam and don't take the final, you're going to end up with you'll end up with 2 scores. You'll end up with a 0 in the final, and then you'll end up with the 2 highest midterm scores. So you have to take the final regardless. The extra credit exam will let you drop your lowest score, given that you've taken all 3 exams. Or if you've just taken 2 exams, you get to drop the lowest of those 2. Any questions about that? Yeah.
Can you take the final and the extra credit the same day, or do you have
sure.
to wait?
Okay. Yep. You can take them the same day, back to back, if you like.
They make you wait about an hour between each test.
Between tests? Well, that's good to know. I didn't see that on the testing lab page. I'll talk to Tony about fixing the pace of students know that. Is it between attempts on the same exam if someone offers multiple attempts, or does it take different exams?
I think it's between different exams. Some kid
wanted
to take another test
and they said, you had to wait a half hour. I will check on that and get back to you. But yeah, you can take them on the same day, and there may be a half hour wait period depending on what the policy is. I know that sometimes in the same course, they might have a thing, or if the instructor allows retakes or something. But I will verify and get back to you on that. Okay, let's talk about religious knowledge. So, often people say religion is a matter of personal belief. And this all goes back to week one. What is truth? Truth is that which corresponds with reality. So when you're talking about religious truth, there's no reason why it shouldn't be any different than any other kind of truth, right? George Washington had wooden teeth is a proposition. That proposition is either true or it's false. How do you tell whether the proposition is true or false? Well, you look at the available evidence. You look at are there any documents do those documents have corroboration? Is this a belief which is at variance with, say, the science of the times? If it's the case that wooden teeth weren't invented for another 100 years, then that would be a strike against that belief. If it turned out that it was an urban legend that a story that postdated the president by 100 years, that would be a strike against it. If George Washington were on record to say something like I came into this world with my own teeth and I'll be going to the grave with my own teeth, right? That would be a strike against it. So you gather historical evidence in this case because it's a historical claim. And so you look at Jesus rose from the dead. How do you tell whether that's true? Well, in the same sort of way, if it's a historical claim, it's claimed to be a historical event, there's supposed to be eyewitnesses, you look at the quality of the documents, the quality of the testimony, and then you make a judgment. And then you run into problems like, well, this is a miraculous event, and then all the problems that Hume raises come up. So to believe Jesus rose from the dead, you're going to need a lot more evidence than George Washington had wooden teeth. And so there's a higher standard of proof. But at least it's open to empirical investigation, right? And so when you think about religious claims, you can start thinking about verification, so how to test a religion. Try to verify historical claims. If any. And these are particularly true in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. So you can look at the Bible and see whether it's when it speaks on matters of history, whether it can be verified. And at least that's going to be in favor of the Bible if you can show through archaeology and through non-biblical sources that the Bible seems to get the history right. And that would establish the Bible as reliable in matters of verifiable fact. And then you can sort of deal with the miracle problems maybe. But at least if you look at the Bible, it turns out that there's no proof that any of the things happen. Like, for example, and I don't want to step any toes in here, but this is like talking about verifiable archaeological and historical facts. If you compare the Bible to, say, the Book of Mormon, the Bible is used as a guide by archaeologists when they're looking at Israel. And it says Jericho was here, and it describes the geography in intricate detail. The archaeologists go dig, 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 dig. Hey, here's the city of Jericho, and here are the walls that came down. Wow, that's interesting. And so on. You have from Dan to Beersheba, all these places in the Bible have been dug up and known to exist, with a few exceptions, like in the early parts of Genesis, Sodom and Gomorrah. Still haven't found the Garden of Eden between those Tigris and Euphrates rivers, although we have a geographical location for it in modern-day Iraq. But, you know, if you look, if you go past, like, the kind of folklorish, mythological chapters in Genesis, and you go into the history books like Kings and Chronicles, and even actually back to some of the things in Genesis, you can find, you know, the Red Sea and all the areas there in the Bible, they actually existed. In the same way that they dug up the city of Troy, and it existed. If you take the Book of Mormon, though, and it talks about a high material culture in the Americas. And, you know, there was no high material culture in the Americas. You didn't have, you know, advanced metallurgy. You certainly didn't have elephants. And you have all these things that are described in the Book of Mormon as being in the Americas that there's no evidence that they existed. And it conflicts with everything we know about Mesoamerican archaeology and history. And so that, so to me, like if I'm sort of looking at religions, I'm thinking, is it the Bible or the Bible plus the Book of Mormon? That's a big black mark against the Book of Mormon, in that it, not only is there no independent archaeological verification for it, for the history and for the cultural information, but it actually conflicts with most of what we know about Mesoamerica, you know, the Central and Southern America. And they haven't found one Nephite or Lamanite culture. And the only relic from these civilizations spoken of in the Book of Mormon was the Book of Mormon, these golden tablets written in Reformed Egyptian hieroglyphics, which is a language nobody's ever heard of. There's a professor that Joseph Smith brought the runes to, these runes to, and wanted him to look at them. And the professor says they look like they were crudely, you know, sort of copied and modified from, you know, these hieroglyphs. And you sort of, you do some poking around, and you see there's no evidence. And the Book of Mormon is only, the golden plates were only seen by three people, and I think either two or all three recanted their testimony later. They, you know, they saw these, they saw something that Joseph Smith had, and it's just these three guys, and that's it. And you can't go to the museum and see the Book of Mormon. Whereas you can go to, like, the Dead Sea, see the Dead Sea Scrolls, for example, from the Qumran community. You can, I went to the University of Chicago and I got to see the Dead Sea Scrolls. There they are. And there's, you know, the ancient manuscripts in these special boxes to keep them from falling apart. There's a little light that goes on and it's like motion sensed so that they don't degrade. And you can go in there and you can see the actual manuscripts that are, you know, 2,000 years old from the first century. But there's no first century copies of the, or it wouldn't be first century, but it would be whenever the Book of Mormon is supposed to have taken place. I think years at, so in the years after Christ, maybe some stuff beforehand. I think the story is that the lost tribes of Israel sort of came over to the Americas. Anyway, but you can do read in the history and you can make a judgment. And I think, you know, as far as history and archaeology goes, Bible's looking pretty good. Book of Mormon, not so good. You look at the Quran. The Quran seems really good in matters dealing with 7th century Arabia. But when it speaks about biblical times, you get all sorts of mistakes and anachronisms. You get Pharaoh threatening to crucify his magicians. So his, in the Book of Exodus, it talks about there's a sort of contest between Moses and the Pharaoh's magicians. And Moses, you know, throws his staff down and it turns into a snake. And the Pharaoh's magicians throw their staves down and they turn into snakes. But then Moses's snake eats the other magician's snake. And then in the Quranic version, which seems to be a sort of rehashed and modified version of the biblical story, Pharaoh gets really mad at his magicians and he says, "I will crucify you all." Well, the only problem with that is, well, what is the problem with that? Anyone know? Why is that a problem?
Crucifixion,
was
that like Roman?
Yeah, crucifixion's a Roman thing. And it didn't come around until, you know, a couple hundred years before Christ. So you're dealing with, like, you're off by about 1,000 years. You see this guy named Haman shows up as the Pharaoh's chief advisor. And Muhammad seems to confuse Haman with the villainous advisor to King Ahasuerus from the Book of Esther. Right? So you know, he's making these mistakes. And, you know, Muhammad was an illiterate man. He couldn't read. And so when you get a person who's, you know, sort of running a caravan business, the equivalent of a guy that's like managing a trucking firm, right? And he doesn't have any religious training, and he's getting these secondhand stories from other people. You would expect him to make mistakes like that. But you know, would you expect God to make mistakes like that? Probably not. So I think that's a strike against the Quran too. Even though the Muslims will tell you that the Quran is perfect in any way, in every way, and to the extent that it disagrees with the Bible is just wrong. It got corrupted somehow. So you can go through, I think, and look at what historical claims are there and see how they match up with earlier sources, with history, and so on. The moral character of the founder. And also the moral teachings, I think, too. So you can look at, like, if the founder of religion seems to have been a charlatan who is, indicted for perjury, has a sort of odious personal history. He seems to be using a position for personal gain to get women, fame, and fortune. Might not have been sent from God, right? That would be my reaction. Not to say that a person can't be, you know, a minister of God and not have moral flaws, but if this person just seems to be a really odious, bad human being, that doesn't seem like the kind of PR God would want and the sort of person he would choose to be his minister. You know, unless God is something like Satan or something, he's malevolent and malicious. But so that might be one thing you could do. You could also look at the teachings of the religion. And if the religion, endorses slavery and supports genocide and the wiping out of indigenous peoples and forcing people to obey religion through threat of violence, forced conversions, treats women as second-class citizens, establishes a highly stratified social structure where there's no social mobility. Executes people for things like adultery and homosexuality. You sort of go down the line and think about ways in which you look at these ancient books. And I wouldn't say that they're all pretty much the same, but you get a lot of teachings which conflict with our modern notions of right and wrong. And I think if you get a moral code, which seems to be a sort of a copy of the barbaric culture in which it emerged, that might be a reason to think, this might not be from God. You know, would God send his followers out to wipe out people and steal their land and destroy all their temples and take all the valuables and put it in his treasury? It seems like a morally perfect being wouldn't command that sort of thing. Now, maybe a priest who claims to be speaking on God's behalf might do that. I'd be surprised if a priest speaking on God's name who is, you know, sort of interested in personal gain wouldn't do that. But it doesn't seem like the sort of thing that God would do. And you look at notions like curses and blood feuds and those sorts of things. And if you find blood curses where you get the teaching that if something bad happens to you, it's because one of your ancestors did something wrong. That seems sort of unjust, right? And so you think about if God punishes people for things they didn't do, that's not a God of justice. And if God's morally perfect, he would have to be just. And then you could look at a lot of different aspects of the moral teachings. Superstition. If you get sort of non-scientific, but anti-scientific views, you get a portrayal of a sort of place of fiery torment that exists under the earth, or the idea that God lives up in the sky someplace, and those seem to be pretty primitive views. If you get the idea that disease is caused by evil spirits, that also seems to be somewhat of a primitive view. If you get sort of folk remedies, you know, being pitched, there's a place where in the Bible where Jesus puts a mixture of sort of putty or clay and spittle on this guy's eyes and cures him with this sort of folk remedy. You have Muhammad telling his followers to drink a mixture of camel urine and milk. And I was thinking maybe you just feel worse than the disease, and I don't know, or maybe you like you suddenly get better. Oh no, thanks, Muhammad. I'm completely fine now. So I don't know, but you get, or he says, like in one place in the traditions of Muhammad, the Hadith, he says, if a fly falls into your cup, don't worry about it because one wing contains poison, but the other wing contains its antidote. These are kind of, you know, primitive, superstitious beliefs that you wouldn't expect a person who's in touch with the Lord God of the universe to teach. You know, other things about the sun, like the astronomy, right? So you have God makes the sun stand still in the book of Joshua, which implies that the sun's moving around the earth, which is, you know, what people in the ancient world thought, apart from the Greeks who figured it out. But then, yeah, because of the church and because Aristotle screwed up and the church canonized him as a saint, there's 1,000 years of the alternative view that the earth's stationary and the sun moving around it is sort of is there because it's in the Bible and it's in Aristotle, and both of those were considered to be, you know, perfect. And anybody who challenged it was suppressed. Other teachings, like I think Muhammad talked about the sun sort of being the size of a basketball, and you get Joseph Smith talking about people, he's a founder of Mormonism, talking about people living on the moon that dress like Quakers, and Brigham Young gave, you know, had one up on that and said that there are people that lived in the sun. So you hear, or that gold and silver grow out of the earth like plants. And so you get all these teachings. You think, okay, if a person's really hearing from God, they're speaking God's name, and you get these sort of things that they don't fit in with what we know through science. You think, oh, were they really hearing from God or not? And then finally, internal consistency. Does the religion have an internally consistent teaching, or does it change over time? And you can see, if you look in the Old Testament, God seems to evolve from the sort of tribal, localized deity who doesn't know things and makes mistakes and throws temper tantrums, to this sort of idea of the Lord God of the universe, who knows all and sees all and is eternal and is the only God there is, whereas early on in the Bible, it's not clear that he's the only God. You get this idea that you shouldn't worship any other gods. Why? Not because they don't exist and you're wasting your time. It's because God is a jealous God. And if you worship other gods, he's going to punish you because he wants you only worshiping him. And you get in the book of Exodus, after the Pharaoh's armies armies drown in the Red Sea, you have Moses writes a song about us, a victory song. And one of the lyrics is, "Who is like you among the gods, O Yahweh?" And it seems that in Moses' mind, there are other gods out there. It's just Yahweh is head and shoulders above them. He's the greatest God. But other gods exist. But by the time you get to the book of Isaiah, it's God says, "Is there any God besides me? I know of none." And people that worship other gods are made fun of for worshiping idols instead of the true God. So you can follow this belief with regards to the soul. You find no idea of the soul in the Old Testament. You get the idea of resurrection, of bodily resurrection, but there's only like two or three verses in the whole Old Testament. There's one in the book of Daniel, which is probably one of the latest books written. And there's one cryptic little verse in Isaiah that says your dead will rise, and it's about some prophecy about the end of time. In the book of Daniel, again, there's talks about a resurrection. The beliefs in the afterlife, interestingly enough, came in the Old Testament came around when the Jews started mixing with the Zoroastrians, the Persians. And the Persians had a belief in resurrection. They had a belief in Satan. And surprise, surprise, around that time, the Jews start believing in Satan. They start believing in like hierarchies of angels and demons, and they start believing in the afterlife. And then when the Greeks come in, the Jews start believing in souls. Why? Because Greeks believe in souls, and the Greek culture sort of mixes with Jewish culture, and then you see beliefs in the soul cropping up. And the belief in the soul and the belief in resurrection sort of get glommed together. So by the time you get to the New Testament, you got souls, you got resurrection, you got Satan, you got angels, you got demons. And so when you follow this along, it's hard to look at this and say, well, this is a book that was sort of dropped from on high, and these teachings are being dictated by God or guided by God or inspired by God. They just seem to be bubbling out of the different cultures as they, you know, mix and match and as these beliefs evolve. And so that seems to be problematic for any book that you know is or any series of books, actually. The Bible is 66 books, not just one. But any series of books which spans time, you see, if you see changes and evolution and development of religious concepts, there's always the question of what's the true concept? And which one belief do you go with? You just go with the last thing that was revealed? Well, does that mean the thing that's written earlier isn't true? You have this problem with Vatican councils too, and even more problems. So if you get the Bible, it's, you know, where you have all these different teachings, and the later stuff seems to contradict the early stuff. When you have the Vatican councils, and you get like the Council of Trent that says if you're not a Catholic, you're going to hell, and then you get like the Vatican II that says, oh, you know, Christians, Buddhists, Muslims, Jews, and yes, even Protestants can be saved. Right? So totally different than the Council of Trent. And you can look at all these Vatican councils and they seem to say different things. Well, which ones are being guided by God? And you know, does God change his mind every 50 or 100 years? And there's this other idea, I saw this in the forum, this idea that all the religions can sort of be right at the same time. That's just not going to work because religions teach different things. This might be a shock to you. I'd suggest take any of our religion classes here. And you might get an instructor that might emphasize like the idea that the you know, beliefs, the similarities between beliefs. But you'll notice some differences. In Christianity, Jesus is the Son of God. In Islam, God has no son. That's seen as heresy, as blasphemy. In Judaism, Jesus is not the Messiah. In Christianity, he is the Messiah. And so you look at, although the three Western religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, have a lot in common, and they're interrelated, and they share some scriptures, you get different teachings even there. You go to Hinduism and Buddhism, and it's a whole different ballpark. Right? You get reincarnation and karma and all these concepts which are totally foreign to the Bible. So, and then there's the sort of the internal consistency in teachings, and then maybe in the concepts, too. So it doesn't make sense. I'll put teachings over time. As if teachings over time, and then the concepts themselves. So the teaching over time is, does the early stuff agree with the later stuff? You can look at this with Hinduism either. I don't want to pick on Christianity too much. You look at early Hinduism, and of the Vedas, the earliest scriptures, and it's, you know, be a good person, worship the millions of gods, and God will let you into heaven. And then later on, and there's this idea, well, these different gods are really manifestations of the same God, and you shouldn't pay too much attention to like scriptures and rituals and ceremonies. What you really need to do is go off by yourself and meditate and realize the oneness of all things. Totally different from the teachings in the Vedas. But what happens is you get this religion metamorphizes from this polytheistic religion of sacrifice and prayer, the sort of traditional polytheistic religion of sacrifice and prayer and worship and ceremonies and festivals, and it evolves into this mystical religion of you know, meditation and karma and reincarnation and these other teachings, which you can't find in the Vedas. You find this in the Upanishads. And this is where you get this idea that you're God and I'm God and everything's God and everything's one. But you can't find that in the Vedas at all. You get a totally different teaching. But what happens is, in religion, you never throw anything out. It's, you know, religion is all about sustainability. So, you know, you can't just jettison the belief. So what do? You just sort of glom new stuff on the old stuff and not care that it contradicts the old stuff. Because, you know, contradiction isn't that much of a problem. So anyway. But so there's my little spiel on religion. But you can see there's a way of looking at the different religions and say, okay, this one looks pretty good. This one, you know, this looks like this is, you know, Scientology. Scientology is like a scam cooked up by a science fiction author. Sorry, I hate to, you know, the truth hurts sometimes, but, you know, if there's any Scientologists out there, I apologize for your hurt feelings, but not for giving you the straight scoop on Scientology. And the stuff you can find, if you kind of dig around the internet, you can find all the teachings of Scientology. And L. Ron Hubbard's a sci-fi author. You know, I would be a little suspicious of a religion whose founder gets paid to make stuff up, right? You know, tell the one Dean Koontz described, because the one who has his book Telling Lies for Fun and Profit. It's about how to be a writer, right? So anyway, I've been gabbing for a while. So comments, questions, disputations about religious knowledge, about looking at all the religions out there and figuring out which one, if any, are true. Yeah, Michael.
It's interesting that you bring up these points with this empirical means of justifying belief. It makes one realize that there's no actual belief system out there that actually has any internal consistency whatsoever. And it's almost a means of becoming an atheist. Because if we look at a lot of these means, we can see that there are just total contradictions within every belief system. So, I mean, my question, I guess, is, are you advocating for atheism?
No, I think you can actually be an atheist. I mean, sorry, you don't have to be an atheist to think that, you know, no religion is right. You can have belief in God without religion. That's what you get, like a lot of the founding fathers, not a lot of the founding fathers, but some of the founding fathers, like Thomas Jefferson and Thomas Paine and the early Benjamin Franklin. I think later on in his life, Benjamin Franklin got more conservative. John Adams seemed to have had this view that you could sort of have to take the teachings in the Bible with a grain of salt, but these people still believed in a personal God. And they thought that God gave man free will, and that they set down a moral law, that there's a heaven and a hell and a last judgment. But you know, the particulars of Christianity, and particularly the Old Testament, they thought that this wasn't inspired by God, or maybe it was sort of inspired, but not like the literal word of God, and people sort of got things wrong. So this doesn't say anything about like the concept of God itself. Right now I'm just talking about grading religion. Although you could look at the concept of God as sort of an abstract concept and have an argument about that too. But as far as like looking at religions, I don't know if I haven't, if there's a religion here I haven't mentioned. But you can, I mean, there's responses that these religions will give about why things seem to change over time. And some people say, well, it's, you know, progressive revelation that God sort of talks to people in ways that they can understand at the time, and that God's kind of playing to the lowest common denominator. So, I mean, it's not as if there aren't answers. But I'm just saying that to think that you just can't use your mind for any of these things. And you can pick up a book like To See the Other Side. There's a book called Evidence That Demands a Verdict by Josh McDowell. Most of it's, you know, references to other primary sources, but it's a good collection of all the arguments in favor of Christianity. There's a book by Lee Strobel called The Case for Christ. C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity is also a classic. So I mean, you can read those and see what you think. Leeson Archer has this Encyclopedia of Biblical Difficulties. And I specialize in Western religion, so these are the sources I know. So I'm not saying you should be an atheist. I'm just saying that when you're looking at the different religions, you can do some investigation and see whether how much what they have going for them and whether there's any big red flags about, is this the sort of thing that God would say or establish? Do you have your hand up?
Yeah, so if you go through this, what's the best way to do all these steps? Is it to get all the religious books together and do this step by step by step through each religious book? Or is there, you know, people that you can trust that have found things? What's the best way to do this?
Oh, that's difficult. What's like the shortest way? I mean, I suppose you can get a degree in religion, but that's a big time investment, right?
Yeah.
You'd be like... you know, the guy who gets a seminary degree and then finds it and ends up being an atheist and then ends up getting a job teaching or something. There was actually, I had a professor of mine, he was like a Seventh-day Adventist, and he had a divinity degree, and then he went to get his doctorate, and he had like a doctorate in theology, and then he picked up like one other, like a sort of secular degree, because his sectarian degree from a Seventh-day Adventist school wasn't going to get him any jobs teaching a secular university. So he got yet another degree, and then he ended up teaching. So how would you start out? Well, I would just say, like, you know, look at the basic beliefs of each of the religions and see if you can go, is there some, like, fatal flaw or something that sort of where you can say, well, this one, you know, initial plausibility, you might sort of rank the religions and say, this one looks pretty good. This one, you know, you might like list like the ones that seem like they're right out. Like, and I would say, you know, as you look through here, like science, this sort of Scientology would be one example. And maybe I would say, as far as objective evidence, the Book of Mormon, not looking too good. And you look at the members of those religions, there's a strong emphasis on an emotional attachment. Rather than rationality. And then sort of go through the line here. And you can even pick up like an introductory book on these teachings and see what you can find too. Or just, you know, take one of our world religions class. Actually, we have this is probably a good chance to shamelessly shill for our Religion 199. I don't remember if that was offered. Anybody taking that in the spring? Can't remember if we decided that in spring or fall, but we've got a new intro to world religions class, or you can take it at the U too, just to sort of give you an idea, familiarize with things. In the fall, we'll be doing a religions of the Middle East class. I'm actually on sabbatical, so I won't be there teaching it, but we'll have somebody there. And actually, there's a guy that might be interested in, Steve Savlich, who's a Christian, has taught that for us before, and he might be teaching one of those sections. So I'm saying, like, if you want to find out about, like, the best defense of Christianity, you know, I would say go to the best people. Just don't read, like, you know, an angry atheist book like Richard Dawkins. Like Richard Dawkins' book on is it The God Delusion? When he tries to speak on matters of religion, it's kind of embarrassing sometimes that he doesn't know what he's talking about. He's mostly interested in slamming. So if you look at sort of, you might read. But he's good at matters of evolution and talking about natural selection. He's really good. But, you know, if you read like C.S. Lewis and his Mere Christianity, or Josh McDowell or Lee Strobel, one of these guys, and sort of read The Best Defense, and then like read the Skeptic book and kind of compare and contrast, I think you get it, at least as far as Christianity goes. And you can think about the broad ideas too, so... Anyway, this just gives you a bare outline of how you would go about it. And, you know, when it comes to me, like my time, like I sort of kind of give a cursory look at, say, I can't remember. Like there's this thing called A Course in Miracles by Marian Ann Williamson. I used to live in Santa Barbara. And it's these series of books that are dictated through automatic writing, which is sort of a person goes into a trance and they start writing stuff. And you know, I read a synopsis of just like a few of the course sections. But I mean, this is like, it's like thousands of pages. I don't have time to read thousands of pages. So I sort of get a taste for it and think, this seems like the usual like sort of New Agey stuff. And from some suburban housewife, or actually I think that comes from somebody else. The suburban housewife is Jay-Z Knight, who channels Ramtha. And I read Jay-Z Knight's probably got like 12 books out. So I read her big one, I Am Ramtha, and read it, and I'm like, yeah, this, and there's all sorts of problems with it. But at least, I read it. I read this like many lives, many masters, attempt to prove reincarnation. So you do what you have time for, and you go with what's most plausible. Because it could be a 24-hour day job reading the next book on religion, trying to prove which religion is right. So you sort of, you do a lot of work at the front end, and then you make some decisions, and then you can sort of check off things by process of elimination. That would be my general advice. And try to narrow it down to maybe the Eastern or Western religions, or one particular religion that looks like it has a lot going for it. Okay, long-winded answer. I think we have to move on to talk about moral knowledge. So knowledge of ethics, remember in the first chapter, I talked about the fact that sometimes relativism is rejected for metaphysics because it's seen as ridiculous to think the Earth is both flat and round, that it's both the center of the universe and it revolves around the sun. Right? Both those things can't be true. People can have different beliefs, but then there's a reality to which those beliefs either match up or don't match up. And that's this notion of objective truth. But in ethics, you run into this problem about what could be an objective truth about ethics. Why is there a problem with ethics compared to other things? Why is it tough to think about ethics as objective? Yeah.
Is it an emotional issue? Personal issue?
Well, that seems like it might be big in the question, though, if you say ethics is personal.
Well, it stirs emotions rather than just being...
Right, so maybe emotions would interfere with being objective? Is that what you're thinking?
Maybe. I don't know.
So,
that would
address. Yeah, so let me just... objective. So if we think about an ethical truth, are there any universal objective ethical truths? But seems emotional, it's very personal. I guess by personal, there's sort of this idea everybody has their own code of ethics.
Has their own ethical boundaries.
So, but it seems like that, people have different forms of scruples, and usually this is around the periphery of ethics. There's a book I was reading, and the author suggests doing a kind of dry run for hawking stuff on the internet, and then to find out, to sort of test the waters to see what the market is, and then once people click the buy it button, you send them a message that says, sorry, we're out of stock now. We'll contact you when goods are available. And doing this with an eBay auction. And then he comments, and it's Mary is uncomfortable with this, and she finds it to be deceptive, therefore she's going to do this alternative strategy. So he gives you two strategies, one for the person with no scruples or conscience, and the other one with the person that thinks it's really important to be honest. And his idea is sort of that, it's kind of iffy, it's not illegal, but you're really not out of stock. It's just like saying, allow 4 to 6 weeks for delivery. Well, it doesn't take 4 to 6 weeks to get a package across the country, right? What happens is they get the order, they send it to the manufacturer makes more on demand, and this avoids stocking costs. Kind of sort of deceptive, but it's a common practice. So, you might think that those things, like one person who's sort of scrupulously honest might think, oh, that's wrong. I'm not going to do that, even though everyone else is doing it. I'm going to, do it some other. I'm going to do it some other way, even though I'm going to lose money, or I'm not going to make as much money. I suppose, I don't know if you think of another case that, like, another case where, like, there might be difference in, like, conscience. Like, what about a person who's, like, doesn't eat meat or something, for example? I don't know, I mean, people say this, right? That, I don't eat meat, or this person doesn't eat meat, it's wrong for them. But, I don't have any feeling guilt when I eat, like, a big, juicy steak, and I think these animal rights wackos are, nuts. So it's good, it's right for me, wrong for them. What's, anything wrong with that way of thinking?
Well, it's just kind of like saying, like, for us in our culture, that women are, like, on equal terms with men, whereas in other cultures, it's not so much.
Yeah, so it's like saying, hey, if you're living in Saudi Arabia and you can't drive a car as a woman, tough luck or something like that. That's what your culture is. Yeah, your culture is Islam and women drivers aren't allowed. And I'll forego any sexist humor about women drivers. but you look at that culture and that's the end of the case. And the cultural relativism problem you get is, well, what about Nazi culture? Oh no, that's the Nazis, they're bad, right? Well, if lots of Jews in Germany and people love Hitler, high degrees of racism, what's the objection? If you get the majority, if you're saying the majority determines what morality is, then it's hard to, it seems like you either got to bite the bullet and say it was right for them to execute the Jews, or you'd have to say, I guess there's some trans-cultural standard of morality. And the thing of the meat eating case, too, like it depends on what kind of vegetarian you are. If you're an ethical vegetarian, you might say something like, well, I don't like the idea that animals are factory farmed, that they're mistreated in a cruel fashion. And I think to participate in cruelty of that magnitude, is morally wrong, even though it tastes good. And to participate in the mistreatment of animals to give myself pleasure because I like the way meat tastes, a vegetarian might say, I think that's wrong. Now, they might, as a pragmatic way, say, I'm not going to judge you, and you can look at it yourself and make your own judgment. But I think, that person probably thinks that everybody should be a vegetarian. Or at least that everybody should eat, should eat vegetables, and if they're going to eat meat, it should be, free range, on an organic, grown on a farm, and so on. So even there, it seems like, is it wrong to, keep animals in enclosed areas in the dark and ruin excrement for years, and then, kill them in painful ways? It seems like you're dealing with the infliction of pain into, sentient life. And that those seem to be, now you're talking about moral issues that seem to be objective in nature. But then the problem is, why is it wrong to cause pain to another sentient being? If it is, what makes that wrong? And it all has to do with this this idea of truth. Truth is that which corresponds with reality. So the question is, what is the moral reality to which moral truths correspond? So, a cat is on the map. So how do we tell that? What's the reality this corresponds to? Well, the cat on the map. So here's the cat. Here's the map. Here's the relation. And we see whether these agree or not, using our senses. Seems like it's easy. But then what if you have something like capital punishment is unjust? Or it's wrong to pour out pirating music on the internet is okay. Or whatever, take them to all the judgments you make every day. So what do these refer to? I mean, can you do the same thing here?
Say that one again.
Can you do the same thing with the cat is on the mat as you can with the
no.
capital question? No. And so why not?
Maybe you're
putting
the cat on the mat.
Okay. Well, I know what that is. You look and some guy, you know, child killer rapist, and they gave him the lethal injection. You can.
What is it?
The last part of it.
The idea.
Yeah.
Oh, what does this refer to? And people disagree with this, right? I mean, they get disagreement about what unjust means.
It's debatable.
There you go.
Yeah, or this. It was okay, is another word for morally permissible. Yeah, so that's a problem. That what is there like some transcendent set of moral truths sort of out there floating in the ether, rightness and wrongness? Going back to Plato. Plato had this idea that concepts are real and that they exist in some other world and that they actually create the material world. And, you know, this, remember early on I talked about this sort of idea of the form or idea of man. And the form of man creates all individual men. And they participate in the form of man. This idea of real concepts. So you can think about justice as sort of an abstract ideal existing out there in the ether. And it's what that which makes every action just. That seems kind of weird. I don't know, is there another way? Is there a way around this, I suppose? Yeah.
I think we have some guidelines. I think that pirating music on the internet is not okay because it's against the law. And I think that the law should be somewhat of a...
Well, there's things that are against the law that a lot of people think.
Well, sure, I get that. But I just think there are guidelines just for certain.
What about click it or ticket?
Yeah.
Okay, what about Drive 65? What about getting the back of the bus if you're black? Or, going back to the women in Saudi Arabia that can't drive the car. How about, I'm trying to think of what's been in the news lately.
Wiretapping.
What's that?
Wiretapping.
Illegal wiretapping? Or... Oh, yeah, there's all sorts of laws, like you can't record a call that... You know, without someone else's consent or something like that. Yeah, yeah. This question about guidelines. Where do the guidelines come from?
Society.
Yeah. So, and actually, Hobbes talked about this. If I mentioned this, Hobbes is sort of this idea of the social contract. Yeah. The law. What's moral is what's legal. What's legal is what's moral, according to Hobbes. And he says the law is just there to protect you from other people hitting you over the head and taking your stuff and killing you and raping, assaulting you. And so what happens is human beings get together, they create these common laws, don't kill, don't steal, don't murder, and then they establish a government and a group of sort of professionals who strike fear in the heart of robbers and killers and rapists and then punish them in some draconian way. And so it sort of scares people into respecting the rights of others. Because according to Hobbes, people are always out for their own self-interest. And so what you need to do is establish a society that makes it in your interest to respect the rights of others. And that's one way. It's called the legal positivism.
I mean, otherwise we're just thrown out to like make our own set of ethics and morals.
So you think it's one or the other? It's either obey the law absolutely, or
I think there's other guidelines to follow. But I mean, I don't think that we're all just. I don't think we can just pick and hate. I don't know.
You think about the law as the moral legitimacy of law. This is something that's going to come up in our contemporary moral issues class I'm doing next term. You know what? See, you have people up in Salem and maybe down at the Eugene City Council. What do? They write words on paper. Why did they get the word write words on paper and you didn't? Well, because they got out there and they said, check my box. And they had all their followers wave a sign that said, vote for this person and check his box so he can write down words on paper that you have to follow. And the same thing with the ones in Washington, right? It's just, and how did they get there? Well, they got a bunch of people to give them money, and they bought a bunch of media ads, and they got people to check their box, and now they get to write words on paper that everyone has to follow. That seems like a kind of a weird and screwed up system. And if you don't follow, then you're punished. And there might be some good stuff in there, like, you know, law, like the penal code that says, you know, don't hurt other people and respect the property. But there's all sorts of crazy stuff mixed in there, too. I bet they tell you, you know, that regulate every facet of human behavior from when you wake up in the morning and go to sleep at night. Michael.
So I'm just curious, with Hobbes' standpoint on law being a moral issue, what would he think about smoking pot? Is it legal? Does that mean it's immoral?
Yeah, Hobbes, I think. Well, that's the point. It seems like the legal positivism breaks down in that respect. Now, Hobbes actually says the purpose of the law is to protect your enlightened self-interest. So you can have safety and security, which everybody wants. So if you're worried about a no-knock raid in the middle of the night when you're doing what you want and not hurting anybody, and you live in fear and terror and you lose all your banking secrecy and there's gang wars and you can't take a walk in the forest because there's people with illegal grow operations. You look at all the negative aspects of the war on drugs. I think Hobbes would say it's not really a proper role of government. But then the only way he goes out of that, he says, well, the government's not doing its job. People are going to get fed up and they'll have a revolution and they'll get a new government. But that seems like a pretty inefficient way of doing things, too. You get a lot of violence, it's not really realistic either, that people have to get pretty fed up before they start a revolution.
Hobbes was dealing from a point of fear, though, wasn't he?
Right.
For him, if he could draw a negative attribute to the society from the action which was outlawed, he would stand on the side of the law. It would be, if the grow operation maybe had weapons that were involved, or if there was a fear to, or if there was a social damage, he would stand on the side of the law, because the Leviathan would stand. It's not about rights for Hobbes, right?
Yeah, it's about enlightened self-interest. So it's like she said, you got to have a law, because otherwise, if you quote our president, there's got to be some rules of the road, right? But he doesn't want rules for the road. He wants rules for the sidewalk and for the every back alley and for your own living room. But so this idea that there have to be some rules, otherwise it's chaos and anarchy. Although maybe anarchy might be a good thing. Anarchy doesn't necessarily mean disorder. Anarchy just means no authority telling you what to do. So you get somebody like Locke, actually, who provides an alternative. Locke has this idea of natural rights. And this is the view that the Founding Fathers had, this idea that everyone has innate rights to life, liberty, and property. The Founding Fathers thought property was too narrow, and so they changed that to the pursuit of happiness. But that was thought to include property. Most people forget that, and I think that it's too bad that they didn't use the word property and then put the pursuit of happiness on top of that, maybe as a catch-all. Because now that your absolute right to life and liberty are seen as being pretty good, but the right to property has gone out the window. Mm-hmm. But so anyway, life, liberty, and property, and this idea is that, you know, if someone you have a right to live, and to not, that means you have a right not to be killed by somebody else. And so it's the role of government to protect your right to life. The same thing with your right to liberty. You have the right to freedom of movement, to do as you please, as long as you're not interfering with somebody else's right to do as they please. And so that is a case, again, if the government is there to make sure to preserve your liberty, not to give you a bunch of rules to follow, but to make sure you're as free as possible and that you're not interfering with the freedom of others. And then your right to property, that you have the right to be to own property, to earn money by working, and to pass on that money to your children if you want, or do whatever you want with it, to blow it in Vegas. And then you have the right to enjoyment of the fruits of your labor. And then government is there to keep other people from stealing your stuff. Makes intuitive sense. Now, these are things that most people would sort of nod their head in agreement with. But then the question is, you know, where do these rights come from? I think that's what Hobbes would say. Are they sort of written in stone someplace, or do they go to religious justifications of morality? They sort of the Platonic idea of the rules of morality just are. The concept of natural right is you know, where do these come from? Your nature as a human being.
It could have evolved over time.
Give a right evolving though. It seems like a right is different from like a capacity. Like you might have abilities that evolve over time, like your ability to, you know, create technology or to solve problems or something like that. But the idea of a right, maybe people's recognition of rights seems to evolve over time. There's a question about what a right is. It might be, though, that a right is just sort of goes back to Hobbes. It's a right is something that you grant provisionally in society, and it's sort of something that if you recognize it, it will lead to the greater good. But some people, you know, treat rights as an axiom. They say, look, you got certain rights. You have the right to life, liberty, and property, and that's it. And you sort of, that's not something that you can question or justify by some other set of propositions. But then, you know, where is the reality to which those truths correspond? Again, you get this big question mark. Now, I think what Locke might say is that, you know, it might seem like it, that this concept of rights is what leads to each person fulfilling their life to the utmost. So if you live in a society where the rights to life, liberty, and property are preserved, you end up with everybody being better off. This is what Locke calls a harmony of interests. And the harmony of interests is just the idea that it might seem that it's in my interest to knock you over the head and take your stuff. But then if I do that, then you're going to be mad at me, and other people around the neighborhood are going to sort of be in fear and worry, and they're going to want to find the guy that did that to their friend, because they don't want somebody going around robbing and stealing from them. This goes back to Hobbes. Hobbes talks about a state of nature where there are no rights and where there's no government to enforce those rights. And he says it would be, you know, life would be poor, solitary, brutish, nasty, and short. So you would have, you'd just be going around trying to, it would be like a riot, right, when there's no police and people know the police aren't coming. And what do people do? They drink a lot of alcohol and they start breaking stuff and breaking out the store windows and running out with the stereos, right? And then what does that mean? Well, like the day after, there's no stuff in the store, right? And so if you didn't get in there and get yours, you're kind of screwed. Are they going to make any stereos? Well, you know, the company that made the stereos probably isn't going to send them to that area. And if you had that happen on a worldwide basis, what would happen to manufacturing? What would happen to just all the things that we enjoy, mass communications, modern medical technology? You end up with like places like, you know, in Iraq after the war, people, when everything's destroyed, people go in and they strip all the copper off of the factories and start carting away drums of nuclear waste, thinking that might be worth something. So, I mean, you end up with like all sorts of bad things happening when you get a breakdown of social order. Social order is really in everyone's interest. So, and in a society which has free exchange and production of manufactured goods and relative safety and security, you know, you don't realize what it's like to live in some place like Guatemala or the Palestinian territories or the outskirts of Israel, where every day you're worried about a rocket attack or drug gangs with machine guns. And they might just, you know, kill you to take your digital camera. Or Compton, I suppose. I mean, there's a place in the United States, Detroit. Yeah, along the border with Mexico, right? You know, just the idea, like I live in the Grove where it's great. And I can go take a walk at 2 o'clock in the morning. I have not a care in the world. I can go to the what's that?
What did you say? Where do you live?
Oh, Cottage Grove.
That's where I live too.
Maybe some areas of Cottage Grove is not quite like that. I'm in a suburban area near a school. And it's, you know, it's safe and it's quiet and people are friendly. You know, if you're like living in Guatemala or something like that, you don't want to take a walk by yourself. You'd be particularly in certain areas of town, you're like a marked person. And I go out like in the woods and I take pictures with my $400 camera. You know, I wouldn't do that in a lot of areas of the world. So the idea that Hobbes says is that just going on self-interest without any sort of fancy big concepts of you know, absolute justice, having rights and responsibilities in a society that punishes those who steal and kill and rewards those who respect the rights of others, is going to be better for everyone. You'll have more opportunities for personal advancement. You'll have more safety and security, and everybody will get ahead. Let's see. What else about this? A couple of other answers to this sort of problem of moral knowledge. You get the view that of David Hume. He's mentioned in the text. So Hume has this view called motivism. This goes back to your comment about it's all about emotion, or it seems like there's a big emotional component. So emotivism says that there is no such thing as moral truth. It's just a bunch of emotions we have. That, and as you said, that we evolved with. So maybe we did evolve moral feelings. You can't really evolve a right, but you can evolve moral feelings about rights. So where did morality come from? Well, you know, human beings are social animals. We evolved. Hume doesn't talk about evolution, but it's sort of consistent with this. So Hume just says we have these natural sentiments. And actually, Hume got a lot of his ideas from Adam Smith, the father of capitalism, interestingly enough. The two of them were pals. But Hume developed this into sort of a big, full-blown, popular theory. And the idea is that moral statements are neither true nor false. They're just expressions of emotion. And so if I say capital punishment is unjust, what I really mean is I don't like capital punishment, and neither should you. And I wish there were never any executions. And it's not as if there's any fact in the matter, it's just my preference. And so morality, according to Hume, is just made up of statements of subjective preferences about what you like or don't like. And so take the simple case, like, you know, murder is wrong. It just means, you know, boo murder, right? Or down with murder. And I don't want to be murdered. I don't want my friends to be murdered. And I wish there never were murder. And that's all murder is wrong means. It's like murder bad. Right? Helping people is good. If I say, like, charity is good, I mean, I like it when I read some story about a person helping somebody else that needed help. And it gives me warm, fuzzy feelings inside. Charity good. And to Hume, that's all there is to morality. And it isn't even about like the what the creed of civilization, which will be better for everyone. It's not that rational. It just has to do with these non-rational feelings we have. Now, it just so happens these non-rational feelings, according to Hume, give rise to the social institutions we have. So you start out with these feelings, and like it would start out maybe as your feelings for your friends and family, and sort of the maternal love, and brotherly love, and then you get these abstract ideas like all men are brothers, and you know, we're world citizens, and we are a part of a global village, right? So all these ideas are abstract concepts that have just evolved over time, but really at its base, it's based on family relationships, you're wanting to perpetuate your genes, tribal affiliation, and these things part of our ancient history and our nature as social animals. It's just sort of gotten pushed out into civilization as abstract concepts and then formed into institutions, which, you know, benefit us. And so maybe that's what all there is to morality. Yeah?
I was just going to ask, what would Hobbes say to the Romans? One of the ways that the boys would be able to be soldiers is they'd have to go out in the middle of the night and kill slaves without getting caught. That was the main thing. It was morally okay if they were not caught. If they were caught, it was punishable by death.
Mm-hmm.
What would he say to that? Because it's a social contract for them. They were a pretty brutal society, really.
Yeah. It's a good question. What would Hobbes say about the sort of, I suppose, if the slaves are like a small number of slaves, I think he would say it's in the interest of the slaves to rebel. And he might also say something like, well, look, if you're a slave owner, you don't want your slaves just being killed left and right by the government. And so you probably should complain about that. But I mean, he wouldn't say it's necessarily unjust. I think what he would say is that that seems like a waste of human resources, maybe, what he would say. And, having soldiers going out in the middle of the night killing people who, you know, do useful work for society just seems like a stupid thing to do. So he might find some other sort of moral way of trying to argue against it. Because what's moral is really those laws which best protect overall the life, liberty, property of people. But there's always this problem about what about this particular case where it seems like really intuitively something wrong is going on there. Going back to Locke would say those slaves have a natural right to life, and they also have a natural right to liberty, and that's why slavery is immoral. And I suppose the right to property wouldn't apply since he didn't think people could be property. That's all we have time for today. So we're just going to do political knowledge next time and review for the final.